The Dress Without a Name. In the mountain villages of Veldrath, seamstresses passed a saying down through generations the way other families passed silver. A needle knows the truth of a person before the person knows it themselves. The saying meant that cloth cut for vanity hung crooked no matter how straight the scissors, and cloth cut with care sat perfectly on even the most difficult body. It was not magic. It was attention. It was the willingness to see. Maren Ashvile had heard it first from her mother, who had heard it from her grandmother, who had learned it in a workroom not unlike the one where Maren now sat. A low-ceilinged space beneath the great hall of Solrin Keep, lit by tallow candles and a single east-facing window that gave light for only 4 hours each day. The rest of the time, Maren worked by feel and memory, which suited her. She had learned to hold the shape of a thing in her mind long after the light had failed. She was 23 years old. She had no wolf. She had no pack standing. In the hierarchy of Veldrath, where shifter blood ranked everyone from the Alpha King to the lowest bonded servant, a wolfless Omega was less than a leaf in the hierarchy's wind, present, perhaps necessary in some seasonal way, but not counted. She tucked the saying away each morning like a tool she would need later, and she threaded her needle, and she sewed. Chapter 1. The Commission. The Crimson Solstice came every 7 years, and with it came the measuring. Every unmated Omega of eligible age in the Seven Territories was required to present herself at Solrin Keep to be fitted for a formal gown. The Alpha King would review each woman at the Solstice Gathering, choose his mate from among them, and the bonding would be formalized before the winter moon crested. It was tradition. It was law. It was, in the estimation of most of the Omegas who arrived in long, anxious lines at the Keep's eastern gate, approximately as romantic as a livestock auction, though no one said so aloud. Maren had been commissioned to sew all 43 of the gowns. She had not been asked. She had been told by the Keep steward, a narrow man named Voss Drellick, who had a habit of addressing her left ear rather than her face. He had pushed a list of names and measurements across her work table 3 weeks before the solstice and said, "The usual quality will suffice. Nothing extraordinary." Then he had named a price so thin it would not cover her thread costs, and she had looked at the number for a long moment before she accepted it, because the alternative was to accept nothing at all. The gowns were to be in the solstice colors, deep crimson, wine, and shadow black, with silver at the hems. 43 gowns in 3 weeks. Alone. She started before dawn the next day and stopped when her candles guttered out each night. The women arrived for their fittings in clusters, wrapped in cloaks against the autumn chill, filling her small workroom with perfume and nerves and sharp comparative assessments of one another. Maren listened and said little. She measured wrists and waists and the length of a shoulder from the notch of a throat. She noted in her workbook not just numbers, but the specific architecture of a person. The way one woman's left shoulder sat higher than her right from years of carrying a younger sibling. The way another woman's ribcage flared with the particular breadth of someone who ran long distances. She cut each pattern to honor what was true rather than to enforce what the list said should be. None of the women asked her name. She was the seamstress. She was the wolfless girl in the basement. She was, in every practical sense, furniture. She did not particularly mind. She had her work. Chapter 2. The 43rd Gown. On the 21st day, when 42 gowns hung finished on their iron hooks and the morning light was performing its brief daily visit through the eastern window, Maren picked up the order sheet and read through it again. 43 names, 42 gowns. She checked her workbook. 42 fittings recorded in her own careful hand, each woman's measurements confirmed and initialed. She read the sheet a third time. The 43rd name was missing. Not smudged, not illegible. Absent. The 43rd line on Steward Drellick's list read only, "Gown required." Measurement pending. No name. No date of fitting. No notes. She went upstairs and found Drellick in the corridor near the great staircase. "The 43rd gown," she said. "I have no measurements. Who is it for?" Drellick looked at her left ear. "A late addition. The details were not confirmed in time. Make something standard. It won't matter." it will matter if it doesn't fit. Then make it large. It can be taken in. He walked away. Marin stood in the corridor for a moment, then went back downstairs. She had enough crimson silk left for one gown. She had enough time, barely, for one gown, if she did not sleep. She had no measurements, no name, no sense of whose body this dress was meant to honor. Drellick's instruction was to make something standard and large and disposable. She sat down in front of the silk. Her needle knows the truth, her mother's voice said in her memory. She thought for a long time. Then she thought differently. Not about who the gown was for, but about what a gown was for. What it ought to do. She thought about what it would mean to stand in a great hall and be looked at by a man who had the power to choose your future, and to feel, not beautiful in the way that required a mirror's validation, but beautiful in the way that required nothing from anyone. Beautiful, the way something is true, interior and structural. She began to cut. She did not make it large. She made it as if she knew the woman who would wear it, shaping the bodice with a gentle gathering that would accommodate a range of figures without billowing, dropping the waist just below the natural line to give length and ease, setting the sleeves so they fell from the shoulder in a way that made the arms look capable rather than decorative. She stitched the hem with silver in a pattern she had never used in the 42 gowns above it, not a border, but a scatter, like stars flung rather than arranged, the back laced in a way that could be tightened or loosened by the wearer herself, without assistance. She finished it as the dawn of the solstice morning broke through the east window. She hung it on the 43rd hook and looked at it. It was, without question, the most beautiful thing she had ever made. She picked up her workbook, wrote "No name on order" on the 43rd page, and set it down. Chapter 3. The King's Inspection. Alpha King Kellan Voss Arden arrived at the workroom at mid-morning. Marin had not been told to expect him. She had expected Drellick, or possibly one of the senior courtwomen who managed the gathering logistics. She was packing her remaining materials, thread spools, shears, the small bone-handled awl her mother had given her, when the door opened and the room changed. She did not look up immediately. She continued folding a length of spare silk. The seamstress? A voice. Not Drellick's thin efficiency. This voice had weight in it, the way stone has weight. Not threatening, just real. Present. Yes. She folded the last edge and looked up. He was taller than she had pictured a king being, as if the title should have compressed him into something more compact and manageable. He was not handsome in the easy, decorative way of the court men she'd glimpsed through windows. His face was the kind that took looking at. A jaw that suggested stubbornness, dark eyes set under a heavy brow, a scar along the left cheekbone that no one had apparently thought to bother removing, though Veldrath's healers could have done it in an afternoon. He was not in ceremonial dress. He wore a dark riding coat and mud on his boots. Behind him, Drellick hovered like a nervous satellite. Kellan Voss Arden moved down the row of hanging gowns with the focused attention of someone who was actually looking. He paused at several. He reached out once and touched a sleeve, feeling the weight of the fabric. He did not speak. When he reached the end of the row and arrived at the 43rd gown, he stopped. Marin watched him. He stood in front of it for a longer moment than he had stood in front of any of the others. His hand came up and he held the hem, turning it slightly to catch the scattered silver. The expression on his face was not easy to read. It was the expression of someone who had asked a simple question and received an unexpected answer. Whose name is on this order? Drellick cleared his throat. There was a last-minute addition, my lord. The details were not fully confirmed. The seamstress was instructed to make a standard. Whose name is on this order? Kellan said again, in exactly the same tone, which was somehow worse than if he had raised it. Drellick said nothing. Kellan turned and looked at Marin. Not at her left ear. At her. You made all of these? Yes. Alone? Yes. In 3 weeks? Yes. He held the 43rd gown's hem a moment longer. Why is this one different? Because I didn't have instructions for it, she said. When I don't have instructions, I do what I think is true. A silence. Drellick's discomfort was audible in his breathing. What is your name?
Marin Ashvale.
Do you have pack affiliation?
No.
The answer didn't register on his face as a problem or a revelation. He seemed to be turning it over in the same way he had turned the hem of the gown, examining texture, not making a judgment yet. The gathering begins at dusk, he said. I need someone who understands these gowns to be present when they're distributed, in case of fitting adjustments. I'll be there, Marin said, because it was practical and because there was no reason to refuse. She went back to packing her needles. Chapter 4. The Gathering. The great hall of Solrin Keep had been transformed for the crimson solstice. Red candles and iron chandeliers, winter branches stripped bare and hung with garnets. The stone floor swept until it held a dull, honest shine. The Omegas arrived in their received gowns and arranged themselves along the hall's eastern wall, in a line that was meant to feel celebratory, and felt instead like the first morning of a long examination. Marin stationed herself at the side of the hall with a small kit. Needle, thread, a tiny pair of folding scissors. She had changed her work dress for her only good one. Dark wool, worn at the cuffs, but clean. She was not in the line. She was not being presented. She was the seamstress. She was furniture. The 43rd gown had been delivered to the antechamber with the others, and Marin had watched it go with the same feeling she had on finishing any piece. A completion, a release, a small grief. She would not see who wore it. It would go to some woman whose name had been added to the list too late, and it would be beautiful on her, and that was the point. The king entered from the northern door. The room shifted. Not in fear, or not only in fear, in attention. He moved down the line slowly, speaking to each woman in turn. Marin watched his face from the side of the room. He was not performing interest. He was genuinely looking, which made it both kinder and harder to watch. He reached the end of the line and stopped. He turned and scanned the room. His eyes found her by the wall. He crossed the hall to where she stood.
The 43rd gown, he said quietly. Where is the woman who was meant to wear it?
Marin said,
I was never told who she was. The gown was brought up with the others. It's not here. I looked.
She stared at him.
It should be. I sent it. I checked every gown in the antechamber before I came in.
His voice was even, but something moved behind his eyes.
42 gowns. 42 women. The 43rd gown is missing.
Marin turned and looked at Drellick, who was standing near the door with the expression of a man who had committed a small crime and was hoping the larger evening would absorb it. Chapter 5. What Drellick had done. She found out within the hour. Steward Drellick, it emerged under the king's direct and extremely quiet questioning in the corridor, had looked at the 43rd gown when it arrived in the antechamber. He had recognized it as extraordinary. He had made a calculation. An extraordinary gown worn by an anonymous woman with no name on the order was an administrative loose thread. It reflected, in some way he couldn't articulate, but strongly felt, poorly on the organization of the event, which was his organization. A gown that had no name was a gown that shouldn't exist. He had quietly removed it and bundled it into a storage chest. The gown still existed. It had not been damaged. Drellick was a petty man, not a destructive one. Kaelin retrieved it himself. He brought it back into the hall, which had gone very quiet, and he set it on the table near the cold fireplace and looked at it in the gathered candlelight. Marin watched him look at it and saw the moment something resolved in him, the way a decision, once made, smooths the face of a person like water smoothing over a stone. Marin Ashvale, he said. She was already standing nearby, because she had followed him from the corridor, because the gown was her work, and its disappearance had lit something protective in her that she had not known she contained. This gown was made without a name on the order, he said.
Yes.
Which means it was made without a subject, without a commission in any real sense.
It was on the list. I was responsible for it. It was made from what you thought was true. He looked at her, and she realized he was quoting her back to herself. That was your word. True. It was. Who did you make it for? The honest answer came up in her before she could organize it into something more careful. I made it for the idea of a woman who didn't need a king to tell her she was worth dressing well. The hall was very quiet. Kaelin held the gown out toward her. Then it belongs to you, he said. Chapter 6. The Fitting. She did not take it gracefully. She said, I can't wear that. I'm not on the list. I'm not here to be presented. I'm the seamstress. You are the only person in this room whose name I know, Kaelin said. And I have stood in front of 42 women tonight and felt nothing except the awareness that I was fulfilling a tradition rather than finding a truth. You can't just... The solstice law requires that I choose a mate from among the women gathered at Solrun Keep on the night of the Crimson Solstice. He set the gown down on the table and straightened. The scar on his cheekbone caught the candlelight. You are at Solrun Keep. You are on the solstice night. The law does not specify which room of the keep or which side of the presentation line. She looked at him for a long moment. The 42 women along the wall were watching. Drellick, near the door, had the look of someone watching a catastrophe occur in extremely slow motion. You don't know me, she said. I know you worked alone for 3 weeks making gowns for 42 women who did not ask your name. I know that when you were given no instructions, you made something true instead of something sufficient. I know your needle knows the truth of a person. He paused, and something in his expression changed, became careful, which is a saying I grew up hearing and never understood until tonight, when I looked at a gown in a room full of gowns and felt the difference between cloth cut for spectacle and cloth cut with genuine attention. Marin said nothing for a moment. The candles moved in some draft from the high windows. You understand that I have no wolf, she said at last. I understand that. And no pack, and no standing. I understand that too. And none of that matters to you, he said. In my experience, the hierarchy tells us very precisely who to overlook, and then the things we overlooked turn out to have been the most important things all along. She picked up the gown. The room that had been functioning as a changing screen was the small antechamber through the north door. She went in alone, and in the dark, with the sounds of the hall muffled behind wood and stone, she put on the dress she had made for the idea of a woman who didn't need a king to tell her she was worth dressing well. It fit her perfectly. Of course it did. Her needle had known. When she came back through the door, she stood still for a moment and let him look at her, and she looked back at him with the same frankness, and neither of them pretended it was not exactly what it was. Chapter 7. What He Told Her. After they did not stay in the hall, the gathering dissolved in the peculiar way of events that have been superseded, not badly, not with anger, the Omegas moving to the feast tables and finding that the evening had given them relief rather than disappointment, the pressure of being chosen lifting like weather. Drellick removed himself from the corridor, which was wisdom. Kaelin led Marin through a door she had never used, up a staircase that came out onto one of the keep's exterior ramparts, where the solstice night was very cold and very clear, and the mountains around Veldrath were layered in pale shadow. I want to tell you something, he said, before this goes further, so that you understand what you're considering. She pulled the gown's silk tighter against the cold and waited. I have done this duty poorly, he said. The solstice system. I have presented myself 3 times at these gatherings and chosen no one, because I could not in conscience choose a woman I did not know from a line of women who had been required to attend. My council has been increasingly unhappy. Tonight was the last gathering I would have been permitted to leave without a bonding. He looked out at the mountains. I am telling you this not because it changes what I feel, but because you deserve to know that you are not an escape from duty. You are the first person I have spoken to honestly in months. Marin considered this for a long moment. The mountains were patient. They did not hurry her. I have done my own work poorly, she said finally. I have accepted less than it was worth because the alternative was nothing. I have been invisible because it was less frightening than being seen and dismissed. I am telling you this so that you understand what you are considering. I am not meek. I made myself small, which is a different thing. He turned and looked at her. I know the difference. Do you? Your gown is the proof that you know it too. She looked at the mountains because looking at him directly felt, at that moment, like looking at a source of heat, not painful, but requiring adjustment. She said, I would need to know you. Actually know you. Not the ceremony of knowing. Then know me, he said simply. I have nowhere to be that is more important than here. They stood on the rampart until the solstice moon had risen fully above the eastern ridge, and they talked, not about kingdoms or hierarchies, or what the council would say in the morning, but about the things that make up a person when no one is watching. The books he read alone in the pre-dawn hours, the specific quality of grief he still carried from his father's early death, the thing about her mother's workroom that she missed most, which was not the work itself, but the sound of two needles working in the same room. Small things. True things. Her needle would have recognized him, she thought. The cloth cut for this conversation was sitting perfectly. Chapter 8. The Morning After Solstice. The council met at the ninth hour. There were 7 of them, all older than Kaelin, all bearing the particular kind of authority that comes from long proximity to power rather than from power itself. They were not cruel men. They were men shaped by their system, and their system said that an Alpha King's bonded mate needed pack standing, wolf heritage, and a pedigree that could be confirmed in the territory records. Marin sat at the end of the long table because Kaelin had asked her to be present, and she had said yes, and yes was the beginning of not making herself small. The council's objections took approximately 40 minutes to exhaust themselves. They cited tradition, hierarchy, territory law, the precedent of the previous 3 solstice gatherings, the expectations of the 7 territories, and the documented lineage requirements for a bonded queen. Kaelin listened to all of it. Then he said, I will answer each of your concerns, but first I want to ask you something. He looked down the table at Marin. Will you tell them about the saying? She was startled, but she was not intimidated. She said, A needle knows the truth of a person before the person knows it themselves. She paused. My family has kept that saying for 4 generations. It means that honest attention, real attention, the kind that sees what is actually there rather than what is convenient, produces something truer than any set of instructions. The council was quiet. Kaelin said, 43 gowns were commissioned for the solstice gathering. Every gown was made with honest attention by one woman, working alone in 3 weeks, for a payment that did not cover her materials. One gown was made without a name on the order, and was more beautiful than all the others, not by accident, but because when she had no instructions to follow, she followed truth instead. I have been following instructions for 7 years. He looked at his council. I am done following instructions about who is worth seeing. The debate continued, but the room had changed. Marin left them to it. She went back down to her workroom because there were things still to be packed, and because the quiet was hers, and she had earned it. She was wrapping her mother's bone-handled awl in the square of clean linen she always used when she heard footsteps on the stairs, and the door opened. Kaelin ducked under the low lintel. He looked at the small room, the single east-facing window, the tallow candles now cold, the iron hooks along the wall bearing 42 gowns waiting to be collected, and 1 empty hook at the end. The council will consent, he said, not happily, but fully. The precedent will be established, and eventually it will be unremarkable. And if they hadn't consented, he said, then I would have had to make a harder choice. I am glad I do not have to, but I want you to know I had already made it. She looked at him. The east window was doing its morning work, and the light fell across the work table, and the iron hooks, and the man standing in the doorway, who had somehow turned out to be a person she could actually see. I would have gone back to my work, she said. I would have been fine. I know. He moved into the room. That's why this is not a rescue. She picked up her mother's awl and turned it in the light, its bone handle smooth with use. What is it, then? 2 people who did something true, he said, at the same moment. She wrapped the awl in its linen square and placed it carefully in the bottom of her kit.
"Then let's see what we make of it," she said.
Epilogue. 1 year later. The workroom beneath the great hall had a new window now, two of them, in fact, cut into the eastern and southern walls by a stonemason who had taken considerable pleasure in the commission. The light was extraordinary for 14 hours a day. Marin sat at her work table on the morning of the second crimson solstice, with her workbook open to a fresh page, though the solstice gathering had been formally discontinued. The new law, drafted with some help from Marin herself, in conversation with the council over the course of a winter, held that bonded pairs would seek each other through presence and time and genuine acquaintance rather than through presentation ceremonies. It was being called revolutionary. It was being called impractical. Several of the seven territories had adopted it already. The gown she had worn on the solstice night hung on the 43rd hook. It had been offered a place in the keep's ceremonial wardrobe. She had declined and brought it back to the workroom, because it belonged there, between the tools and the light, and the honest work. Kaelin came down the stairs at mid-morning as he often did, ducking the lintel with the ease of a year's practice, carrying 2 cups of tea, because he had discovered that she forgot to make it when she was working. He set her cup on the corner of the work table that she kept clear for this purpose, and looked at the open workbook.
New commission?
In a way. She picked up the bone-handled awl, her mother's awl, which lived now in the small earthenware dish beside her thread spools where she could reach it without looking, and turned it once in the morning light.
I've been thinking about teaching, taking apprentices, girls from the villages.
Wolfless girls, he said. Not a question. Girls nobody is currently bothering to see. She set the awl down carefully, its handle familiar, smooth, worn to the precise shape of her grip over years of use. A needle knows the truth of a person. Kaelin sat on the low stool he'd had brought in months ago and picked up his own tea.
Before the person knows it themselves, he finished.
She looked at him, at the scar on his cheekbone catching the double window light, at the dark eyes that had looked at her, that first inspection morning, with the same quality of attention she gave to cloth, genuinely, structurally, without agenda. She thought about what it meant that the saying was ending the way all the best things ended, not as a conclusion, but as a beginning. Not the paying off of a debt, but the recognition of a value that had been true all along, needing only the right pair of eyes.
Yes, she said.
She opened her work.